got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. I am your host, Cameron English. Today we're taking a little bit of a break from our normal format of dissecting the news, and we're going to focus on some perennial issues that keep coming up on this podcast. And namely, I'm talking about sustainable farming and food waste and pesticide safety. And because Dr. Kevin Folta isn't joining me for this episode, we're going to talk to another expert, a molecular biologist named Jamie Batcher. And Jamie is the CEO and co-founder of Boost Biomes, and the company has developed some novel approaches to preventing food waste and reducing the use of pesticides in agriculture, and the work that they're doing can potentially have a very big impact on food production. So Jamie's going to give us a rundown of how their technology works and the potentially huge impact it could have on food and farming in the next few years. So thank you so much for listening. Here we go. All right, Jamie, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks. How about yourself?
I am so excited. It's Thursday. I can barely sit still. Thank you so much for asking. So before we get into what you're doing at Boost Biomes, give us a little background on you. I always like to ask when we have a scientist on that I've never had before, what sparked your interest in molecular biology, and how did you end up where you are?
Wow. So that's I think that's a kind of a two-part question in a way. The interest in molecular biology really came from my undergrad. There was an evolution class that I took where one lecture had one incredibly fascinating discussion about molecular evolution and having in vitro molecular evolution and tracking that. And that really sparked everything that came afterwards. So that's sort of the ultimate origin. A little bit more, a little bit more recent background. To give you that, to give that background from being a scientist to where I am today. I'm a PhD scientist by training. My graduate work was in evolution. Directed evolution. Some pretty fascinating studies about evolution of early life, but that gave me a perspective on evolution and sort of by association or by osmosis ecology as well, and that kind of stuck with me. So after my PhD, I did a couple of postdocs, and then since then I've been in biotech now for over a dozen years. Most of that time has been at companies working on renewable resources or sustainability. Most of that has been in renewable chemicals, such as biofuels and industrial biotechnology, up until now, where I'm at Boost Biomes as one of the co-founders and the CEO, where we're using microbial ecology to develop new microbial products for food and ag.
Great. And I'm glad you brought up your work with biofuels, because I was going to ask how that transitioned into what you're doing now, developing products for food and agriculture, because the story is really cool. So tell me about the work you were doing in the desert, and I think it was in New Mexico, and then that sort of sparked what you're doing now. Is that right?
It's exactly right. It's about a decade ago, not a dozen years, but about a decade ago, maybe a little bit more than that. I was at a company that was working on making biofuels from algae. In order to do that, of course, you need a lot of algae. And so our scale-up facility was a series of artificially constructed ponds, large bodies of water, in the New Mexico desert. And so if you want to, imagine with me a little bit, you can think of this back in, it actually is close to a dozen years. Imagine December 31st of 2008. And this is, and here the company is incredibly excited. We're celebrating because before the end of the year, we inoculated our first pond with these algae. Fast forward a few months and... this is largely not the work that I was doing directly, but the company was, we were thrilled over the course of that winter. We showed that we can grow algae slowly because it's cold in the desert in New Mexico in the winter. Slowly, but sustainably. Then comes spring. It was roughly March or April. And we get this desperate phone call from the New Mexico team. We're in San Diego. We get this desperate phone call from the New Mexico team saying, guys, something terrible has happened. We walked in this morning and all of the ponds were brown. Now, normally those ponds are bright, beautiful green. So this is obviously not a good thing. That set off some frantic exercises in trying to figure out quickly what happened. And what ended up happening, what we eventually found is that there was a fungus that was invading our pond and killing off all of these algae. Now, what's really interesting here is these were open artificial ponds, right? So even though we might inoculate them with one species, and again, this was one species of algae that we were interested in, you know, the next morning there'd be 1,000 different species of microbes. And if you do the DNA testing, you would find, oh yeah, besides all those microbes, you would find that there were, that there was rabbit DNA because a rabbit might have drowned in a pond, unfortunately. Or you might detect deer DNA because a deer came along and drank from the pond that evening. So you get all kinds of, these crazy things. But to come back to the story, what we eventually discovered was it was a fungus that was killing our crop. And we weren't thinking about it as a crop at the time. We were largely molecular biologists, and that's how we were thinking about what we were doing. But in hindsight, and later on as the company developed, we started to think about it as a crop. And with hindsight of 2020, any farmer would have told us, oh, of course, we're going to have a fungus come in and it's going to be bad for our crop. Anybody would have said that. Well, here we are, here we were in that time, still trying to figure it out and still trying to figure out how do we address this issue with these fungi that are killing our crops. So the company went on and solved this problem using pretty straightforward, pretty traditional agricultural approaches to use fungicides. But one of the ideas that we had at the time, and we were right as a company, the company was right to not pursue this. It would have been too complex, too challenging, and so on. But one of the ideas we had at the time was, what if there was a way for us to control the ecology of these ponds so that of the thousands of microbial species that were there, somehow we can engineer that ecosystem to exclude the fungi? And that was an idea that stayed with me for a very long time. Up until now, where it really becomes a little bit of the foundational story for how we thought about starting Boost, my current company.
Very cool. I always like stories like that because it just gives it a little more of a human face. So this first product you're developing, it's a biofungicide, if I'm not mistaken. And so for people who aren't familiar with a word like that, how does that differ from, say, a synthetic chemical that, like the ones that your previous company used to get rid of this fungus that was ruining your crop?
Yeah, well, in this case, a synthetic fungicide is just that. It's some kind of synthetic chemical. And a biofungicide is when the product comes from biology. In our particular case, the biofungicide is actually living microbes. So the microbes themselves are the product. And so that makes it a biofungicide. Biology killing biology in this case. Our microbes that are part of our product killing the fungal pathogens that affect crops and also affect fruit and vegetables after harvest.
So why is this necessary? Just to play devil's advocate for a second, as you alluded to, there's lots of fungicides available. they're relatively cheap from my understanding, and they're pretty safe in terms of their impact on the environment and how they affect human health. So why do you guys see this as something worth pursuing?
Well, let me take that. I think there's about two pieces to dissect there. The first is, many fungicides are safe, but there are definitely some that are less safe than we would like. So there are some chemicals that are used in fields where, for example, there's legislation being put in place, either has been put in place or will be put in place, to limit how we can use those chemicals. And the reason for that is because they're less safe. So there are some chemicals that are safe. There are many that are not. And so some of the standard things we do is limit the reentry period, for example. How long does the farmer have to wait before their field workers can re-enter the field? That tends to be limited. With some of the harsher chemicals, there's even more stringent limitations, like, for example, having buffer zones between the field and their neighbors, especially depending on who those neighbors are. But even if we ignore that for a moment, that's the sort of the legislative side where there's laws being put in place. But there's also the ultimate consumer side where we as a society are becoming a little bit more interested in knowing what's on the fruits and vegetables that we eat. And there are people who track things like the Dirty Dozen of fruits and vegetables, which tracks which fruits and vegetables have the most number, the highest number of residual chemicals when you actually buy them in the grocery stores. By the way, strawberries routinely tops that list. So to the extent that we have concerns about that, we as consumers, we as society, we should be washing our fruits and vegetables, first of all. But second of all, it's between these two sides of things. The consumers wanting products that have less residual chemicals on them, and legislation that acts on the farmer to make chemical products less attractive. I think of these as being a push and a pull, and together they act on the farmer to make using biologicals more attractive and simultaneously make chemicals less attractive. So we at Boost, we're providing what we think is a really valuable and really important opportunity to start switching out some of the chemical products for biologicals. And let's be clear, Boost isn't the first ones to think of this by any means. The idea has been around for quite some time. There have been some pretty reasonably successful products in the space. What we bring new to the table is an underlying technology, as I was alluding to earlier, about understanding microbial ecology and using that to design products that we think are ultimately going to prove to be better than any other biologicals out there.
Got it. Yeah, very, very interesting stuff. So to give people some context about what we're talking about, I think you said in one of your presentations that fungi destroy, 600 million people's worth of food? Is that annually, or is that, what period of time is that over, so people understand the scale of what you guys are trying to solve here?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly right. It is 600 million people's worth of food annually, and that's just in the top five crops alone. So obviously a lot more food waste outside of that, outside of those five crops. The other piece of information I would add here, this is not specific for fungi, is after harvest, we globally waste about a third of the food we produce. Here in the U.S., we waste over 50% of the fruits and vegetables that we have. And again, that's not at all entirely because of fungi, but fungi, of course, contribute to that. And we think that both in the field, that first example of 600 million people's worth of food in the field, and also the 50% of fruits and vegetables after harvest, we think that Boost has a role to play in dramatically improving those numbers, dramatically lowering those numbers.
So tell us a little bit about the technology behind this biofungicide you're developing, and how is it going to be used?
Yeah, so first, the product itself are microbes, and so that is a spray product. And I should clarify, it sort of depends on what is it that the farmer needs to target. It could be a spray, foliar, for example. It could also be put into the root systems through, let's say, through drip irrigation, chemigation, etc. We expect it to be usable by the farmer, however they normally would apply a fungicide. We don't expect there to be a limitation on that on the farmer. So that's the first part of what you just asked. The second part around the underlying technology. So first of all, there's the product. The product itself is a technology. It's a pair of microbes that work very well together and are very effective. But then there's the underlying that, the technology for how we develop and discover new products. That really is around microbial ecology, as we've alluded to before in this discussion. So just very, very briefly, how that works is we bring microbial populations, microbiomes, groups of microbes from a relevant site. So let's say that we want to develop using the real example we've been working on so far in the company. Let's say we want to develop a fungicide that protects high-value crops from fungal pathogens. Well, then our source material might be the microbes that we can isolate in the lab from the root of a strawberry plant. And when I say we isolate them, I don't mean that we isolate all of the individual types of microbes. I mean that we draw the group of microbes together as a population. That's the group of microbes together, the microbiome. And then in the very, very brief version of describing what the technology is, we set up a very large number of subpopulations where we sample out of that original population, and we look for microbes that statistically associate more or less often than you'd expect by chance in a lab-growing situation. And when we see that, we've taken away all of the variables you might have from growing these kinds of microbes or examining these microbial populations in the field, right? This is a lab experiment at this point. And so these statistical associations or disassociations, that's telling us that there's a real interaction. And we use that unique information that Boost has about real interactions between microbes. Now we use that to identify candidate products, and those candidates are tested in our lab. Those that have the activities we want go on to become product leads. Then we can validate those leads in the lab and in field trials and so on, and ultimately bring them to market for farmers and packagers to use to protect their fruit and vegetables and their crops in the field.
So how close are you guys to launching this? And my understanding is it's not commercialized yet. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
We're a 3-year-old startup company. The mission over our first several years now has been to bring our lead products as far towards commercialization as we can. We've now done that. We're now working with partners who are going to, in a sense, they're going to pick up the baton and bring that to the finish line. And so that process still is going to require the product registration, which goes through the EPA. So we're in the early phases of that with our partners. There's still work to be done. We're probably about 2 years, maybe a little bit less than that, but probably about 2 years before the product will be on the market.
Well, that's pretty rapid, and I'm glad you brought up the EPA, because that was my next question. And I know they generally look pretty favorably on biologically based products because they know more about them, and they tend to be pretty narrowly targeted in terms of what they attack. They're not widespread in terms of the damage they can do the environment. So have they said anything specifically to you guys yet? Have you had interaction with any regulators at all?
Well, we and our partners have had some discussions with the EPA. I think as far as we can tell, and I'm being careful not to put words in the mouths of the people from the EPA. As far as we can tell, I think that our product, you know, falls in what we generally would be looking at in biological biopesticides. And so with these, you know, biopesticides, the standard path through the EPA is that the company looking for registration has to generate a fair amount of safety data, the environmental safety data. And so that's things like, do we, you know, does the product harm rats? Does the product harm birds, honeybees, fish? So we look for the, you know, we generate the environmental safety data and then submit that as a dossier to the EPA. And the EPA then has 18 months to evaluate that safety. They certainly can ask for more data. They can ask, you know, they can certainly ask questions. Biologicals in general have a good record of being approved and being approved, you know, and I think it's also important, a lot of the time when people hear about regulatory questions or regulatory issues, you know, we all, I think, tend to default to thinking about the FDA approving drugs. And I think it's just important to point out that this is very different from what we're facing with the EPA regulation. You know, with when people sort of think about, you know, what you hear in the popular press about the FDA, as they approve new drugs, it's a very long, very expensive process. And in the end, there's sort of this thumbs up, thumbs down process or outcome. And in the end, it's either, you know, it's either an incredible win or it's an incredible tragedy for the company. And as I understand the EPA regulatory process, I don't understand that it's the same risk profile as the FDA approving drug. So I just wanted to add that little bit of information because I think it's an important distinction when people think about regulatory, that what we're facing is not at all what sort of, you know, what's in the popular press that we hear about regulatory issues for biotech companies.
Right, right. And I think the last time I looked at what the approval was like and what I've heard from other companies is that it's typically much less expensive and it takes far less time. Because I know with some agricultural products, it can be a decade or more just because of all the data you have to generate. But I think it was like 2 to 3 years, which would line up with what you said a little bit earlier. So that's exciting, the fact that we can get innovative stuff out relatively quickly.
Exactly, exactly right. And, you know, in some ways, you know, just to add a little bit of color to the origin story, in some ways that was part of the thinking behind the origin story, is that the path to market would be pretty reasonable, you know, in terms of regulatory, in terms of time to get the first product to market.
Right. Absolutely. Well, final question then. I've had as I mentioned to you previously, I've had a couple of people from other biopesticide companies on the show. And I always ask, you know, with all of the, you have these activist groups that are very, very vocal and they're good at, you know, arousing the public's concern about pesticides. And so I always ask, you know, are you concerned that there might be some backlash to the products you're developing? And the answer that I got from them was, you know, people are smart enough to understand the difference between a good microbe and a bad microbe. You know, they understand that E. coli can make them sick, but they also understand that there's bacteria in their yogurt and it plays an important role. Would you generally agree with that assessment of the products that are being developed?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that having the, you know, the respect for the public, I think is important. And I think, you know, respecting that they'll be able to understand that distinction. Having said that, I think it's also useful to point out what is our source material and what is our product and where would those concerns be? So, you know, the source material, like I said earlier, are the microbes from the root of a strawberry plant. Now, that's, you know, that means that the microbes that we are talking about, to a greater or lesser extent, they're already in our food system, right? They come from the roots of plants where we actually eat that fruit, right? The fruit is in the environment of those microbes anyways. So these are entirely natural. They're, you know, they're found on, in, and around the plants that we eat anyways. Boost does not do any genetic engineering. I know that obviously I'm, you know, obviously I know and I'm aware and I keep up to date on some of the concerns around that. We don't do that, right? So we're just using these found bacteria, or I should say found microbes, as product. Now, what's special about the way we do that is because we found these microbes that really do work together. And that comes from the underlying technology. But there's not, you know, to the extent that people are evaluating, you know, their concerns around around pesticides and and biologicals in particular, I think that what we're describing here, in my mind, is, you know, among the safest versions of that the public is going to encounter.
Very good stuff. Yeah, very, very good answer. I always like to hear people say that kind of stuff. And it goes back to that classic point that most pesticides are natural. You know, this is stuff that Mother Earth produced, you know, and I think most people in the public aren't aware of that. So that's a great point to end on. But where can people find out more about what you guys do? Go ahead, and if you're on social media, go ahead and plug that, plug your website,
We've, you know, as a really young company, we've kept a little bit of a low profile. So right now it's really just our website right now, boostbiomes.com. That's BOOST, B as in boy, IOMES.com. And people can look for me on Twitter too. I'm not very active, but I post occasionally.
Okay. And are you on LinkedIn? That might be a better place to interact with you.
Oh. Yes, of course. Yeah, thank you. Yes, we are on LinkedIn as well. And it's, you know, just look for Boost Biomes there.
Very good. All right. Hey, well, Jamie, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.